Welcome to the Arts and Antique Radio Show, where your host, nationally recognized certified appraiser Elizabeth Stewart, Santa Barbara's treasure sleuth, will help you put a value on the treasures in your own home.
Every time it rains, pennies from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven?
So let's find out. How valuable is it?
Hello, 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 Santa Barbara. It's your chantress of everything valuable and beautiful, Elizabeth Stewart. And kind of a, it's always special for me when I get to talk to Greg Gorga. He is you still are, because I just got a press release that we've got a new executive director. Greg was executive director of the Santa Barbara Maritime Museum. And I kind of want to just start this, Greg, with some breaking news. Just received today the announcement today that Dean Noble is our new executive director at the Santa Barbara Maritime Museum. And he's a familiar face.
Yeah,
and so I wanted to have you introduce our artist of the day, who's here with us, Rick Delante. But before we do that, I want to talk a little bit about the new leadership. Just a couple of things I want to talk about before I hand it over to you to introduce us to our new leader, Dean Noble. I want to just say I have been interviewing Greg for at least 18, maybe 19 years. He's been at the museum for 19 years. And Richard and I have often talked with him. And during the time that he's been at the museum, I got to say, what a different museum it was than 20 years ago. And a lot of it is because of Greg. Well, most of it, all of it actually is because of Greg's leadership. He bought out the lease of the property there. I know everybody knows that it's right on the pier. And that was a big issue. I mean, it was when this was done, when Greg managed to do this, buying out the lease, you know, it was on the Santa Barbara Harbor. And we didn't know really if we were going to have a museum anymore. So he bought out the lease, and we have now a lasting home because of Greg. He played a key role in helping the Coast Guard select our museum in Santa Barbara as the Point Conception First Order Fresno Lens new home. Now, if you haven't seen that, you got to rush over and see it. It's fantastic. Greg was kind enough, when my relatives were visiting from Denmark, he was kind enough to host one of the college kids that was super interested in maritime anything. My little niece, not so little actually, 26 years old, but I think of her as a young girl. And Greg gave us a tour of the Fresnel Lens, and she was blown away, you know, to think about, well, when you're in your 20s and you think about something like the Fresnel Lens Lighthouse, the technology that was available at the time and how they actually managed to pull off such a thing on Point Conception is amazing. It's also amazing how Greg spearheaded the move of the darn thing, half fallen apart, and then he also spearheaded all of the leading experts in that kind of Fresnel Lens to come to Santa Barbara. I remember interviewing him at the time. He also helped raise the $400,000 that were needed to restore the lens for our museum. And when you go to the museum, you're going to see that lens right smack in the middle of the ground floor. You know, and the thing about, I was so proud of Greg and of course his staff, you know, and a credible curator that he has on board, and all of the wonderful art that's come through the museum. You know, when you talk about why the museum is a maritime museum, but you also talk about the fact that it's a Santa Barbara Maritime Museum. So our tradition of painting outdoors called plein air painting that is so much a part of both seascapes and landscapes, and it has been for a long time here in Santa Barbara, since the, you know, late 19th century. And so it was a perfect place to start to bring art, and Greg did. Brought beautiful art, and that's one of the reasons we're talking today. We also have a couple of really interesting speakers platforms. I mean, I attended a lecture of surfboard shapers at mm-hmm. at the museum, and that was, you know, something that was, it's maritime, but it's popular culture as well. But he's also got, you know, really distinguished speakers that have come that are actual magnificent scholars. And there's been many book signings there that I've witnessed. And I guess the final feather in the cap was in 2021 when we became accredited with the American Alliance of Museums. So that's just a little bit of, you know, a short segment of the 19 years that Greg has been, you know, with the museum, of some of his accomplishments, extraordinary accomplishments, and he's leaving the museum in, with a, you know, generous future. And I guess we could say that Dean Noble, he actually was the guy that was the I won't say he was the founder, but he was one of the people that really pulled the strings to get the Ealing's Park Foundation off the ground. That was an $11 million capital campaign. And he was the one that restored most of Ealing's Park. If you go up there now, you can see all the outbuildings and the tennis courts, et cetera. He also is a veteran of management at the Santa Barbara Zoo. He was vice president of strategic engagement. He grew attendance and expanded all kinds of events. He actually did, he's actually not a stranger, Richard, to radio. And he's done, our new director, he's not a stranger to radio. And he's not a stranger to videos. And he's not afraid to have his handsome face presented to the public. And that's also really interesting. So he's, we got to get him on the program. But Greg, tell me about the selection process. And have you spoken with Dean Noble? What are his goals? Can you tell us in a nutshell?
Sure. Well, thank you for your very, very kind comments. I wish I could take credit for all the wonderful things that have happened here over the last 19 years. But we owe that to so many other people. But it's been great to be a part of that and to lead this museum for 18 of those 19 years as the executive director. So thank you very much for all of that. So, Dean, it's been wonderful. We started this process a little over a year ago. It was board driven. We had I had announced my plans to step down, you know, about a year and a half ago. And so the board it was all internally done by board members. And we sent out the process was national search. We had 167 applications. I was not on the search committee, but they had 167 applications. They narrowed it down to about a dozen people. And then Dean was, one of our finalists, and really happy to have him selected. He is local, as you mentioned. We had, you know, really good finalists from all over the country, really. So it was really great to have somebody local that the board decided on, and he will be starting on February 11th, so less than 2 weeks. I know he's excited to be here. I think Dean's the type of person, he's going to, you know, step back for a little bit and see what's going on here and how we run things. And then, I'm sure he'll bring in his own ideas and some changes. It's great. His zoo background, I know he worked for Rich Block at the zoo for a long time, and then the last 7 years at Ealing's Park, and has done some amazing things there, like that $11 million campaign. So, you know, he has a lot of expertise in marketing. He's, I think, does a great job with employees, and he's much more handsome than I am. So you're right. So he'll be a much better face for the museum than I have served. And my board like to say I had the perfect face for radio. So So we're very much looking forward to seeing bringing Dean on board, and I am sure he's going to take the museum into new wonderful heights. And so many people I owe my success here to: our staff, our amazing staff, our board of directors, our volunteers, our members and donors who gave us the support. But what we're going to talk about today, really in 2010, I started in 2007, became executive director 2008, and one of the best things I ever did was bring Emily Falk on board as our curator. She was director of education and deputy director at some times, but she has changed the look of the museum, and then of course brought so many amazing artists into the museum. And so we're really excited to have the current show, Where the Mountains Meet the Sea, with so many talented artists, 12 of them. And I actually had some knee surgery, so I missed the opening last Thursday, but we had well over 200 and probably close to 250 people here for the opening, and it was a really successful opening. These pieces are for sale, and we've already sold a significant number of them, so it's really exciting.
And so, how do you divvy up the proceeds then when something sells?
So the museum gets a share, a very significant share. So it's you're when you come here and you see this artwork, I'm hoping you're gonna besides just enjoying it, and certainly you want to come in and enjoy the amazing pieces. There's, I think, 75 of them. But by purchasing the piece here, you support both a local artist and the Santa Barbara Maritime Museum and all the education programming. We serve almost 5,000 students each year, countywide, and all of our wonderful exhibits, and being open to the public 7 days a week. So it's a wonderful way to support both the museum and our local artists who deserve our support. And you're really going to enjoy these pieces because they are amazing.
And when does the show close? I'm sorry, I didn't make a note of that. When does,
So it is up through March 29th. So it's up through most of March. So and again, we're open 7 days a week, 10 to 5. Always check our website in case there's a special event, we might be closed. But the pieces are up on our second floor in our Munger Theater. And we're so glad to have, we did an exhibit. These artists, I believe, are all represented by the Waterhouse Galleries. We worked with them about 2 years ago to do our first show with them, and we featured 10 artists. And that show was so successful that all 10 wanted to come back again. And we added two more, which Rick Delante, who's with us today, I think is, I don't think, Rick, you were here last time, right? This is
I was
your
not,
first.
but I'm happy to be here this time.
All right. Well, we're happy to have you here. So yeah, we added two more artists. So it's been a great show so far.
Oh, well, I just want to introduce, obviously you did mention that Rick Delante is associated and represented by Waterhouse Galleries here in Santa Barbara and Montecito. But he's also a member of some of California's most prestigious art societies. And some of these are pretty much impossible to get into. But he's a member of the American Society of Marine Artists, Pacific Rim Institute of Marine Artists, the National Oil and Acrylic Painter Society, and the famous Laguna Plein Air Painters Association, American Impressionist Society, the Plein Air Painters of Colorado, and he's an artist member of the California Art Club. He's an associate living master with the Art Renewal Center. And then he's also, like I said, associated with Waterhouse and a number of other really important galleries. And one of the things I want to talk to Rick about is I get asked this a lot, Rick. I've been an appraiser of many things, but art is a definite interest of mine. And I've worked in this town in appraising fine art for a long time. And artists that are, they're launching themselves, et cetera, they want to know how to understand how a gallery works and how to become represented. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that. I mean, the days when you actually brought a portfolio in, are those still the same? I mean, do you still present your work in person? How do you, how do, how, if you're, if I was a young artist, how would you say, okay, Elizabeth, here's how you get your work represented by a gallery such as Waterhouse or Illume, or how did you do it?
There are steps, I believe, that prove more successful than other ones. Having a mentor, first of all, that can speak to you personally about specific circumstances, like you're talking about, Elizabeth, is very important. You know, where can I go? Who can I speak to? Who are these people specifically? How can I make connections? And connections, showing interest, being at openings, meeting the gallery owner, talking to other artists that are in the gallery, also going to their shows, all of that helps. The best recommendation for any artist from any gallery is from another artist in the gallery. So you are very fortunate when someone in the gallery decides that you and your work will suit the gallery's intentions and look, style, and your personality would work well with gallery dealers, that they would recommend you, and then you could speak to them. The days of coming into the gallery doors and dropping your portfolio on somebody's desk are over, and many
Yeah.
gallery dealers would be the first to tell you that we don't want to see that anymore.
Well, that's interesting. I've never really noticed the connection between those artists that are in the gallery already to say, "Oh, I've got a friend Rick and he would be a great fit." I've never really heard of that happening, and that's a great tip.
It's the most common way.
Okay. I wanted also to mention, your artwork is in number of books. Some of these authors and collectors that are mentioned in some of these books are huge. Jean Stern, for example, one of the authors of Painting California Seascapes and Beach Towns, another incredible title, California Woman Story, Joan Irvine Smith, with and then a Beauty Unites Us, which is a book of your own, and Jean Stern is forwarding that book.
He
These
did.
are okay. And these are names that if you are in California Impressionism plein air work, they are famous names. Jean Stern, for example, and Joan Irvine Smith, for example. So, how do you get noticed by those folks?
Wow, that's a wild one. I
Yeah.
taught at San Clemente High School for 32 years. In my last year of teaching, I had a student teacher, and I was his master teacher. Will's wife was the personal assistant of Joan Irvine Smith, who you're speaking about right
Aha.
now. And Joan Irvine Smith was writing a book called The California Woman Story. Assisting her in that effort was John Stern. The wife of my student teacher said to Joan Irvine Smith, when she was looking for a painter from South Orange County that she could include in the book, she says, "I know of one." So she set up an appointment with me, with Joan and Jean, and I went into a bungalow and I met them as they were meeting over a couple of plastic tables littered with slides and books and all kinds of materials that they were looking at in preparation for the book. And they, quote unquote, interviewed me and reviewed my slides right there. So, Elizabeth, it was, must have been God at work. Through my student teacher's wife, that I was able to meet Joan Irvine Smith and Jean. Next month, I am going to Paint Maui 26. It's an invitational plein air event, and I'll be giving Jean's lecture for him at the lecture at the event on his behalf, simply because he's not able to attend. I also did it last year. The reason I mention that is that it's so wild to me that. At one point, I was a teacher walking with my work into a bungalow to meet them. And here it is. Wow, what is this? 20 years later, and I'm doing a lecture on his behalf in his favorite place, Maui. The art world is.
What's the topic of the lecture?
Topic of the lecture is Introduction to Impressionism.
And what are you going to cover? I'm just out of interest. So what it did Jean write the lecture and you're reciting it, or did you collaborate? And can you give us like three major bullet points that you'll cover?
Sure. And it is a collaboration. He prepared the slides,
Don't turn
so
that
it's
down.
his
Back in a minute.
PowerPoint. It's my research. So in between the two, we hope to present something that is original between us. And I have to say that during the research for the lecture, even though I've been painting for 50 years, I learned a ton. So John got me started, and with the salon in the 1860s is where the lecture starts and brings us all the way up through California and American Impressionism in the United States in the early 30s and 40s. And it was, the lecture is about how Impressionism
Welcome back.
Actually,
it's Elizabeth Stewart.
Not only the history of French academic painting, but it's actually changed how we see. It's the most popular art movement in the world, and people recognize Impressionism probably more than they recognize any other style. From its debut in the Fontainebleau Forest in the 1860s to the invention of the portable paint tube, through the Salon des Refusés, which is where the Impressionists first exhibited their work together because they were all rejected from the salon, to now where their work has grown in popularity, and even to the point where Eric Rhodes and the Plein Air Convention is making a business out of how to teach people how to paint outdoors in the Impressionist style.
So who is making a business of that? I didn't catch the name.
I don't know if you've heard of Eric Rhodes, but
okay.
He's responsible for the Plein Air Convention and Plein Air Magazine primarily, along with a collector's version of that magazine, which is called Fine Art Connoisseur.
Okay. All right. So I mean, you mentioned some really interesting things, and I just want to mention the Salon des Refusés. You know, when it's interesting, but you're telling the story of a little bit of how French Impressionism kind of trickled into California in a really unique way. But the legacy of Impressionism, one of the things that I really love to think about is the inclusion of women as artists.
Yes.
And yeah, that's a huge thing, a huge turning point. That's we owe that to that period.
Berta Morisot and Mary Cassatt specifically, what you're talking about.
Yes, yes. And, you know, the interesting thing is, you know, we fast forward to places like Laguna Beach and Laguna, where, you know, you have, not only do you have female artists, you know, very early on, but you've got female and husband and wife partnerships too, painting together in California. I mean, it's so interesting to think about the California, you know, female artist in that period, and the previous period, academic painting, you don't see many females in that world.
It was really hard for females to even break in. Well, it was hard for anybody to create a career based on painting as a professional unless they could get their work in the salon. And women were denied even the opportunity to have male models or go to any of the drawing sessions that the males were going to. And of course, I think they were just flat out denied acceptance and entry into the salon itself. So the Salon des Refusés was really significant, not only in giving other artists who were not completely on board with the academic traditions at the salon a chance to exhibit, but also, just like you're saying, women, huge, absolutely huge.
Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about you as a teacher as well, because there's a couple of interesting questions that I was thinking about last night to ask you, and Richard's giving us a sign we got to go to quick break. When we get back from the break, I'm going to ask you about your teaching technique. And you're mentioning 30 plus years as a teacher, teaching art. I want to ask you about that, but also want to ask you about the role of talent. And so those are some of the questions. All right, Richard, let's go to quick break. And just reintroducing, okay, we're talking about a show that's happening at the Santa Barbara Maritime Museum. And Emily Falk, who I adore, and she's a marvelous curator, has pulled together 12 artists that are represented by Waterhouse, Ralph and his wife's Waterhouse Gallery. It's on now, opened last week. It's going to go on till March 29th. And we're talking with one of the artists today, Rick Delante, and his position in California painting, which is pretty important, and as we are hearing. And also the synchronicities that Rick has experienced. That's a cool thing, too. Doesn't happen to everybody, but that is a cool thing, you know, being able to walk into that bungalow and there's John Stern and there's Joan Irvine Smith, and you're an artist who has admired them from afar, and all of a sudden you're presenting your work. So
it's
those
amazing.
Are some. Yeah, it is. It's cool.
Absolutely amazing. When you say it that way, Elizabeth, I'm going, wow, who does that happen to?
Yeah, that's right. As I know, it's pretty special. And you know, that I this is sort of going to lead us into the next conversation I want to have with you about the role of talent. And so, you know, Richard, let's go to quick break. We get back from the break, I'm going to talk a little bit more about the art world, a seasoned artist who's been through a lot and come out quite on top. It was Rick Delante. Don't turn that down. I'll be back in a minute. Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart. I'm talking with Greg Gorga, who is, well, almost past executive director of the Maritime Museum. I just got the press release this morning that Maritime Museum has appointed Dean Noble as executive director. He's a veteran not-for-profit leader, and he's going to succeed Greg after 19 years of service to the museum. And Dean comes to us from the zoo and from Ealing's Park, and he's also quite a media person. And so he is a leader in our community, in the not-for-profit community, and a personality that we're going to learn more about as we go on. And today we're talking with Rick Delante and Greg about Mountains Meeting the Sea, where the mountains meet the sea. This is the exhibit that's currently on at the Maritime Museum. And there are 12 artists that are represented, not necessarily 12 canvases, but 12 artists that are represented. As a matter of fact, that whole upstairs gallery is full, and the works are for sale. You got to get in there if you want to buy a piece, because they're going fast. Greg was telling us that quite a few pieces have sold already in the first week and a half of the show. So, I mean, now is the time to jump. Because not only are you supporting the local artists, but you're also supporting our beautiful museum. If you are interested in finding more about the artist we're talking today, Rick Delante, you want to go to www.delante,
don't turn that down,
DelanteFineArt.com. And I looked at that last night. It's a marvelous representation. You know what struck me most, Rick, about some of the work that I was witnessing there? You've got a tremendous ability to capture depth, you know, depth of field. And that's so difficult when you talk about
welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart.
And, you know, I can actually feel the caverns and the vistas. I can feel how deep they are. And I don't know how that's done. You do it so beautifully. And we'll talk about that in a second. But Rick was mentioning that he was a teacher for 30 plus years. Was it San Clemente?
San Clemente High School.
Yeah. So we asked two questions. Richard and I, over the years, we asked two questions. Most artists that come and speak with us, we ask two questions. Number one is, how do you recognize talent in a student? And number two is, how do you teach a student to know how to stop painting a canvas? So how do you recognize talent, and how do you teach how to stop? And I'll tell you, this whole thing started years ago when we had a teacher from Santa Barbara City College, Michael Drury, come and speak with us. And he's a surfer and a teacher and a painter and just a general bon vivant type of a guy. And we asked Michael, you know, how do you know How do you teach your students when to stop? Because he painted, his subject was oil painting, and he taught oil painting at City College. How do you tell a student when to stop? You know, you're standing as a teacher and you're going down the line of you know, artists' easels, and the canvases are up there on the easels, and you're noticing how, oh, and he says to Richard and I, he says, oh, I know exactly when to tell them when to stop. I said, when? Because, you know, how to make something final in the creative world is so difficult, because, mm-hmm. you know, even Da Vinci went back for years. I'll touch this up. I'll do this. How do you teach a student when to stop? Well, what do you think Michael said? He said, I teach them to stop right before I see them start to paint the brown potato in the sky, which means, Rick's laughing. If you could see what I'm seeing, because we have him on video, you don't see him because you're listening on radio. But the brown potato in the sky is when you muddy up your oil so much that the sky now is no longer blue or white or whatever the sky is in your painting. But the sky is now a mush of brownish tones, because that's what happens when you overwork oil. And so his answer to my question, how do you tell your student when to stop? Well, right before they start to notice they've painted a brown potato in the sky. You have my permission to steal that. I'll let Michael know if
that's
you like.
Good.
Yep. So how do you teach a student when to stop painting? When is something finished?
My own enemy in the studio, number one, is overworking. And through the years, I've decided that I know why that is. And I think overworking comes as a result of underconfidence, is you're just not really sure that you're really there. So maybe if you did this, or, hey, how about this? Then that would push it over the top. Maybe even hoping that some quote unquote happy accident would finish the piece off, and you would look at it and go, there's the masterpiece that I was looking for when I started. However, that doesn't happen, of course, and overworking ends up with clouds that look like potatoes and faces that end up looking mushy with too many details where you don't need them, and it just ends up being a huge mess. So I decided that took me decades, actually. So I was teaching my students while I was teaching myself that overworking really is the enemy, that simplification is actually an art unto itself. In Santa Barbara, there's a master of simplification in the person of Marcia Burt. She's just really an amazing artist. So Marcia knows when to stop, because she views everything as a design, viewing the painting more important even than the reality of the model that she's looking at. So she's always questioning her design and asking when it's done. I'm thinking of John Stern again, and even though he doesn't paint, he said that he had a surefire way to stop painters from overpainting when they were outside, and that was to have them paint in front of two people that would pull them off before they ruined their painting. So that's his idea's physical restraint. John Burton says, John Burton himself, an accomplished artist, said, you know, can't really do that. Can't have those people in your entourage while you're traveling around. But what you could do is just mentally stop when you're at 80%. You decide that you're not quite done. That's the point that you should stop. Because if you leave the painting open for the viewer to participate, the viewer is going to see a lot more in it than if you completely define the piece for him.
Oh, wow. Richard, did you hear that? That's a new one on us. We yep. like that. Richard's nodding his head. Yeah, we like that. So if you, okay, let me see if I can rephrase that. So if you, you're 80% done, and you know you're 80% done, you feel it in your bones, you stop, you pull yourself away, you don't have two people physically grab one of each arms and throw yourself back off the cliff, except you pull yourself away when you're 80% done. And why you do that is so that you leave that 20% experiential space open for the viewer to jump in. Did I get that right?
You did get that right. I didn't mention one thing that's very important is that if you're working and have been working for, let's say, hours, and let's say it's late at night and you're at 80%, you know that you should go to bed and that in the morning you should look at it with fresh eyes. Some painters even turn that canvas to the wall and work on another one and then turn the canvas around, you know, 3 or 4 days later and look at it again, because that kind of hindsight, that kind of reevaluation, wow, speaks volumes to whether you are finished or not. So the big thing is just don't keep working, especially when you feel like you're fatigued or when you know that you've been standing in the same spot for several hours. It's time to get out. And that's why I think plein air painting is so important. The sun changes its position dramatically in 2 hours. Any plein air painter that is standing in one spot for more than 2 hours is actually working in a different day, because the sun has changed so much that the light and shadow patterns are incredibly different. So plein air painting, forcing you to make decisions, get it together, put down your spontaneous and intuitive responses, is a good thing to carry into the studio so that your studio work can have the same vitality and freshness that your plein air work does. Working outside is a great way to stop overworking your studio work. Finally, Jeff Sewell, one of my friends, Elizabeth, Jeff Sewell, he had one piece of advice on that, as he says, when you finish your painting or you think you're finished and you're considering another move, you know, just one more move, ask yourself, will it make it better or will it simply make it different?
Oh, that's another good one. Richard likes that one too. We're writing these down.
Yes. So we can.
Richard, actually, we're kindred spirits. He is very interested in the process of creativity and the process of visualization and seeing and not just looking. And so we have that in common. Very good. So the second brilliant point is that when you are about to question, we're about to finish and you've got that brush sort of hovering, you say to yourself, is this going to complete it? Am I going to finish this, or or am I making this painting a different painting?
That's it.
Yeah, that's really good. We love it. That applies to everything. Applies to writing, dancing, all the creative arts.
Yeah,
doesn't
music,
it,
all of it.
Yeah. Okay, Richard's saying we got to go to a quick break. And okay, when we get back from the break, we want to talk about how Rick recognizes talent. I think that's an important thing to talk about with a teacher that's mentored so many people and so many a young artist, how you recognize talent. And just a quick codicil to that. So, Rick, I have two brothers, and one is kinetically incredibly gifted. So it's the smaller of the two brothers, very low center of gravity, smaller than me, very strong, can pick up any sport and master it very quickly. Never became a master of any one sport because everything came to him so easy. My other brother, tall, gangly, not very coordinated, not really great at any particular picking up quickly sport like my other brother, but what he had was discipline and mm-hmm. determination. And he made himself a master of one particular sport by just sheer force of mind, mm-hmm. you know, just so you've got talent on one side. I grew up with it. Extreme talent on one side, extreme discipline on the other. So I want to talk about that when we get back to it. Okay, Richard, let's go to a quick break. Don't turn that dial. Back with Rick Delonte. Welcome back. And just to preface this by saying that this conversation is in celebration of an exhibit at the Santa Barbara Maritime Museum right now. It's called Where the Mountains Meet the Sea. Of course, that's us. And this is 12 artists with many canvases that are showing in the upstairs gallery at the Santa Barbara Maritime Museum. All these artists are represented by the famous Waterhouse Gallery, which is here in Santa Barbara and in Montecito both. And one of the artists that is a guest or is a painter for the show is Rick Delonte. He is actually lives in San Clemente, California, but he paints many places, many, many places. And as we learned from talking with Rick, he is going to be speaking at the Plein Air Conference in Maui. So he's painted all over the country, Colorado as well, I understand. And I think you are a member of the, Plein Air Painters of Colorado, for example. Richard and I are always interested to know how a master teacher recognizes talent. And we've asked this of all sorts of creative people. I'm really interested when I have a master teacher who's a master dancer. We had a gentleman come on who was a master teacher in tango and was one of the, you know, world's famous tango dancers and also teacher. How do you recognize talent? You know, is it something that you just know? His answer was really interesting. If Richard will remember, he said, you know, it's something in the spirit of, you know, because they're auditioning, there's something in the spirit. It may not be the finesse. It may not be the perfection of footwork but it's something that I'm noticing that just draws me, that is a passionate feeling that the dancer has. But at any rate, it's not about the form or the finesse. It's just not. Even though dance is very specific form, you know, ballet, for example, mm-hmm. tango, for example. But it's not about that. He says, I've auditioned people who have just the basic, you know, in ballet, there's the basic foot positions that you must know. And he said, you know, we have that as sort of rudimentary, but they get it wrong and I'm still loving it. And he says, it's not the form. What do you think, Rick? How do you recognize talent in your young students?
Being a high school teacher, it was my job to take all kinds of different students into the class. So it wasn't really about students signing up for an art class because they wanted to adopt the profession of becoming an artist. More often it was credits, units, space in the schedule. I want to do something easy outside of my honors classes. And in some cases it was, I've known since I was five that I was going to be an artist. And finally, I'm in a real class in the high school that I like. So there are all kinds of different students in front of me. So what I decided early on is that I would look at each one of them as vessels with potential, that every single human being that has abilities of any kind can develop those abilities into what they want. And you mentioned that your brother had discipline and determination, that sometimes it's not about wanting to become an artist. It's wanting to become a human being who fulfills everything inside of them, which I think is really the role of any teacher, English, history, science, you know, whatever it is the students that are sitting in front of you deserve your 100% attention to help them get on the track where they feel like when they exit from high school, they are prepared to live life, at least as a young adult, because they made decisions about themselves as far as where they're at, you know, mentally, intellectually, socially, et cetera. And that's no different in any of the curricula, including art. Art does not have a monopoly on things of the spirit, but it's a whole lot easier to teach it there than it is in English. I know because I started in English. And wow, I've read enough papers on Macbeth. I've read enough lousy writing. I've read enough unprepared expression that kids just hadn't developed by the time they were freshmen, that just made reading their work extremely brutal for anybody that needed to take them from here to there, you know? So I got to tell you, Elizabeth, my first couple of years of teaching in ceramics and English was very, very tough. ceramics. The ceramics room was called the mud room by the administration, which gives you an idea of their estimation of it. And reading English papers on the weekends and after school till 9:30 at night. I really wondered if I was in the wrong profession. Third year, my department chairman, our department chairman at the high school retired. I asked the principal if I could have it. And he said, you're in drawing and painting. From then on, I began to see kids not only with talent, but just kids interested in school. And that's like number one. The kids come in the door and they're going, Mr. D, I love this class. And they love the class because it's free. You know, it's about them. It's not about some abstract body of work. So that's where I started, is making it about them. And our first projects usually had to do with line designs. I'd give them a ruler and I just have them just go at it. I'd give them a few examples and say, you know, make some line patterns. And I wanted to do a project where there was 100% success. Everybody can create a design using lines. And then I went into perspective and more rigorous kind of things later. But I tried to, quote unquote, hook them by showing them that everyone can do this. This is not a class of just talented students who have been, quote unquote, good at art from the time they were five. This is really a chance for you to find out what kind of creativity you have inside of you and to plumb those depths, whether you use that creativity later as an auto mechanic or a drapery designer or a parent, is that you have it. You have creativity inside. So for me, talent was definitely on back burner. But there were those kids, you know, Elizabeth, they come right to the front and you see them. And I, well, here's an example. I did a perspective lesson at the board. I'm drawing at the old green chalkboard boxes and 2-point perspective, 1-point perspective. Everybody's got their ruler. I'm giving them exact measurements how to do it. So now I walk around the room. I'm in the back of the room. Here's this guy. He's got a whole Western town with gunslingers and he's got clouds in the sky and he's got birds, you know, above the, and he's got a hitching post and stagecoaches. And I'm going, holy cow. The guy just naturally understood what I was trying to communicate through the use of the vanishing points, did it on his own. So I just let that guy go. Here's another example that a teacher might think would be an obstinate student, is I couldn't get this guy to do anything but trucks and motorcycles and cars. And I said, Warren, don't you think we could do like a still life or like a face, or, you know, try something different? No, not doing that. Doing the cars, doing the trucks, love this stuff. You know, I'm going, okay, I'm going to leave Warren alone. And Warren eventually ended up going to Art Center and then became the team leader for the Toyota Solara. So standing out of Warren's way and not getting in there and go, Warren, you are not doing the prescribed curriculum. You really need to get your act together here so you can get credits and you can graduate this. I didn't see that. I was going, Rick, you're an art teacher. The guy's doing art. He's passionate about it and he's succeeding in what he's doing. Get out of the way.
Fantastic. So, fantastic.
There is a way that students can grow without the teacher leading them by the nose. And I think in general, you would call it encouragement, a way to teach dance, a way to teach somebody how to, the way through an automobile engine, the way to teach them how to do a 3-point perspective so that they could eventually become an illustrator. You know, that's all you got to do is say you can do it. And then you show them they can do it by taking them from step one through step two. And as a teacher, you have to know what that is. You know, what is too difficult and too advanced? What is too basic? You don't want to give somebody that's really into it something that's really basic, because that kills them just as fast. So encouragement, I think, is the whole, it's the whole game. So I wasn't really concerned with talent. I went, that's not my job. My job is to encourage all kids so that they would grow to their full potential in the class. So even the kid that wasn't going to be a professional artist, when he went out of the class, would go, that class was fun, and I learned more about myself.
Fantastic. You know, we have to say goodbye, but Richard and I are both so thrilled that you came on and gave us some philosophy. And I got three things from today. I bet you Richard will agree. I got Rick is about creativity, composition, and confidence. Yeah.
I would agree with that.
Yeah, that's what he's about. Creativity, composition, and confidence. And we
All
love
I can
it.
tell you, Elizabeth, is I got nothing. No, I'm kidding.
No, I mean, I could see the thing
It
is
was
that,
great.
dear listener, when we do these shows, Richard and I can see our guests and we can see each other. And we've been doing this show together every week for about 20 years now.
Yeah.
So we are on the same page, totally. Creativity, composition, and confidence. I can't tell you how fantastic the show, Where the Mountains Meet the Sea, 12 artists, wonderful representation of our area, our mountains, our sea, etc., all represented by Waterhouse Gallery. Rick Delante was one of those artists, and he's been kind enough to come on and tell us a little bit about his philosophy, his history, and some of his achievements, which are numerous. I love it, don't you, Richard? Creativity, composition, and confidence. Yeah, we love it. We're going to put that over our desks. Thank you very much, Rick, for coming
Elizabeth,
on.
Could I say one thing to Greg before we sign off?
Yeah, Greg, are you still there?
That museum is awesome. And I want to thank Greg and Emily especially for having us there. The way that I learn about life and art is through sketching. I take my sketchbook everywhere I go. Every time I go in the Maritime Museum, I cannot believe what I learn about indigenous people, tool making, deep sea diving, boats, all kinds of things that I personally am not doing, but I feel like I can learn more about just by going to the Maritime Museum. So Greg, awesome job, man.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
We applaud you, Greg. Thank you so much. And would you give our congratulations to Dean Noble, and we look forward to, you know, many years of enjoying his expertise. And we have definitely had your expertise and your goodwill and your good humor lead that museum for many years. And we're so appreciative here in Santa Barbara. Thanks
thank
for
you
everything.
Very much. And I will miss being on this show. I've had so much fun over the years. So thank you very much for all the shows.
Thank you. Richard and I both love having you. Bye, everybody.
Bye. Thanks, Rick.
Bye, Greg. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you.